Älskar du den här podden? Stötta den genom IKAs nya supporterfunktion. Det är helt upp till dig hur mycket du vill bidra med och det finns ingen bindningstid. Klicka på länken i poddbeskrivningen för att visa din uppskattning och stötta podden.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Varmt välkommen till ännu en MotoGP-podd. Andreas Mårtensson och Tobias Lyon som vanligt laddade inför fullmatat program. Andreas, hur är läget med dig?
Det är mycket bra. Jag ser fram emot den här podden vi har framför oss.
Det gör jag med. Det är en podd som fortsätter lite grann på temat som vi har slagit in på här nu. Presenterat oss själva lite mera. Vilket jag för övrigt tyckte var, det var väldigt roligt att göra. Både att faktiskt att prata om sig själv men även att lyssna på det du har varit med om under din karriär.
Och även all feedback som vi har fått ifrån de här senaste 4 avsnitten som har varit nu över jul och nyår. Det har varit roligt.
Ja, det tycker jag med. Och sen så blir man påmind om grejer som hänt för väldigt länge sedan. Roliga saker, spännande saker och ibland mindre roliga saker. Men det är ändå nyttigt att lyfta upp. Så att jag ser fram emot dagens podd också. Det kommer att bli superintressant.
Ja, det blir ingen riktigt vanlig podd den här gången heller. Nyhetsläget inom MotoGP, det kommer vi återkomma till. Det har hänt lite grann nu med Brivio, med Dovi och med allt som har hänt nu senaste tiden. Men det har ändå inte hänt så jättemycket grejer. Så vi sparar på det lite grann och så går vi in på dagens podd. För vad ska den handla om, Tobias?
Ja, men vi har fått tag på, äntligen fått tillfälle att ha med Neil Spalding, teknisk guru måste man säga framförallt. I alla fall jag personligen som träffade Neil Spalding första gången 2009 vill jag minnas, i Qatar. Ett ödsligt hotell, lite kufibritt men med oerhört tekniskt kunnande inom MotoGP då. Som dessutom skriver, fotograferar och är kritiskt tänkande människa. Han har ju skrivit en bok, MotoGP Technology. Och det är väl hans stora bidrag inom MotoGP måste man säga.
Absolut, och den har blivit lovordad av folk som är inifrån också. Alltså från Ulins till olika märken som jag vet har uppskattat den här boken. 3 versioner han skrivit och senaste gåvan som gavs ut, den kom ut i slutet av 2019 års säsong. Så att den är ganska aktuell, det är bara 2020 som saknas och det är inte så konstigt för att han har inte fått resa precis som vi har inte fått resa. Väldigt, väldigt bra och detaljerad bok om man är intresserad av det tekniska i MotoGP.
Riktigt sån snokare, men nästan som man ser honom med det här förstoringsglaset går runt och Han kommer in och lyckas ta reda på saker som annars kanske bara förbehållet de som jobbar med märkena. Eller
ja, lite så är det. För om du och jag springer runt i depån, i pit lane pratar jag nu om, och tittar på olika cyklar och sådär, så är det inte så många som liksom höjer på ögonbrynen. För de vet att vi ser inte det de inte vill att vi ska se. Kommer Neil Spalding dit, då åker draperierna ner, tänkte jag säga.
Garageporten åker ner. Japp. Ja, nej, det är precis så det är. Och vi har ju också använt honom, eller jag har använt honom i beskrivit och förklarat olika tekniska frågor, även i sändning. Men nu kommer ett fullmatat program med intressant fakta och tankar och funderingar kring årets säsong.
Ja, vi försöker gå igenom helt enkelt 2020 års säsong, märke för märke, positivt, negativt, vad han tror om framtiden. Så att väldigt intressant att prata med Neil.
Förbereder på en fullmatad dryg timme. We have Neil Spaulding with us from Great Britain. Hello Neil, how are you?
All right, thank you very much. Greetings from lockdown Kent.
How's life been this year? We know each other from before, from many years in the MotoGP paddock, and especially from writing technical books. And we have used you a lot of times to explain technical stuff for us.
No, it's been good fun. This year has been, or the last year rather, has been very quiet. I went to do the MotoGP test in Malaysia. Quite quickly worked out things were not going to be as we wanted them for the year. And in fact, Dorna didn't let any reporters into the pit lane after that. So my actually on-the-ground knowledge stops there. But it's been a great year to watch. And my spies in the paddock have kept me up to date with some of the more important technical moves.
Yeah, and I know also you're into some own business with the technical stuff concerning clutches.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. I run a company called Sigma Performance. This started over 20 years ago when we were tuning up Ducatis. And one of the things that we got into with Ducatis was slipper clutches. We took a Super Mono to Daytona back in 1998, and we'd actually built a clutch specially for that bike, mainly because the rider we were going to use was used to 250s, and we wanted him to have a two-stroke feel. But also, I was very nervous about letting a two-stroke lunatic loose on my very expensive Super Mono Ducati. So that'll be one of those.
Andreas, you have a lot of experience with 250. What is the difference with the clutches between a two-stroke and a four-stroke?
Yeah, it's a lot of differences between the clutches and the slipper clutch and the no slipper clutch on the 250. So I know the difference.
Yeah, I mean, you get a lot more grip going into the corner, basically, if you're not trying to turn over the engine with the rear tire. So, but you need some engine braking because you want it, the back end of the bike, to stay behind the front. So it's finding that nice little balance. Anyway, we ended up building a clutch for the Super Mono, and here we are 20 years later, and we have a range, I think, of about 70 different clutches, and we can get them onto about 100 different bikes.
And there is a market for it, even though many of the manufacturers have their own slipper clutches now in the bikes.
Yeah, it's no different to Orleans selling a shock absorber. You know, the one that comes on the bike is okay, it holds the bike up. But if you actually want to race, you tend to go up a grade. And we're trying to make the clutch business the same.
All right.
The standard ones are absolutely fine if you're doing absolutely standard things with the bike. But if you want to fine-tune it to do better things. And also, there is a big market in the older bikes. I mean, I think one of our biggest selling clutches is the old 600 750 GSXR from the turn of the century.
All right.
That sounds awful, doesn't it? It's only 20 years ago.
Time goes, time flies.
Yes.
And about today then, as you said, the year has been fantastic. The racing has been really close. All the manufacturers have... not all, but almost everyone has got victories this year, and also the riders have had some up and downs, so we have seen a lot of riders also on the podium this year. And our plan now is to speak about the manufacturers and about the performance this year, and if you can see some positives and negatives from it throughout 2020.
Yeah, broadly speaking, the way the factories have worked out is really in line with their ability to deal with Michelin's new tire. I mean, we knew at the start of the year that the new rear tire would change things. It's more grippy, it's designed to work better at, let's call it, three quarters lean. So that part of the corner where a lower powered but classically inline four bike would be wanting to roll through the corner fast and smoothly. Suddenly they were going to get some more grip. And as with everything with tire manufacturer, it's what we call a zero-sum game. If you give somebody something more, it's very difficult not to take something away from something somewhere else. So the tire acted differently in other places. So one of the specific places it works differently is under braking into corners, where the V4s have been doing a lot of their business. I mean, if you think of Marquez's style, he comes towards a corner, he hits the brakes as hard as he can, the bike moves all its weight onto the front tire, it squashes the front contact patch, makes it bigger. The second it makes it bigger, he can put more brakes on. Then he wants to use the rear wheel as well, so to stop it tipping forward, but very importantly to keep the pressure on the front tire, he has to keep the brakes on, but he moves his weight down. And you watch him drop his shoulder or stick his leg out and drop his leg down. Anything to move weight down, that brings the rear tire down. The second the tire hits the ground, he jumps on the rear brake as well and semi-slides it into the corner. Then he hits the throttle to fire it out. And the bike rolls backwards, gets loads of grip from the rear tire, and off she goes. He does that every corner. If we went back 20 years, that would be considered a crash every corner. But he controls it. I mean, he is just unbelievable. But the whole cornering sequence depends on everything working as it should. And it was clear he had a few problems before the start of the year. Another guy who has a very similar style, arguably even more, was Dovizioso, Andrea Dovizioso, where over the years Ducati have tried lots of different things to let him brake harder and harder and harder. He's always been the last of the late breakers. But he again depended on that slide as he tipped the bike into the corner to complete the corner. Suddenly, this new tire's gripping. It's not sliding. For Dovi, it was a problem all the way through the year. I am not going to say Marquez's crash was caused by it, but I would be interested to know what the data trace of the crash lap looked like, in terms of angle of lean, where the grip was, everything else. I mean, you know, Marquez's crash was a bunch of stuff. That's the other thing. I mean, it transformed the year to not have him there, and I feel terribly sorry for his situation. But if he had been there, he would have dominated. But he fell off because he went wide on one lap. He went through the gravel trap. And if you watch him going in, he went in with the little wing still hanging off the bottom of the swing arm. He came out of the corner without the wing hanging on the swing arm. So there's a tiny change in grip. But Marquez is operating in that last tenth of a percent of grip. So that changed something. Then he proceeded to do laps a quarter of a second a lap faster than Quartararo. But he was doing it on a crowded racetrack. It's like trying to do a 100 metres Olympic sprint up a railway platform in a rush hour. It is phenomenal what he was doing. But then he went into that corner and it either gripped or didn't grip, or it did something different, and he's down. And then unfortunately got hit by the bike.
And now when you mention riders more than the bikes, and maybe also the tire that is completely different and very important. So to begin with, then, is it more of a rider concerning the rider technique, or the differences between the bikes? Is it more up to the rider, or is it in the bike?
I think it's both. As you get older, riders don't change their style. They are perpetually looking for the feeling from the bike that they had when they won the world championship, not necessarily understanding that feeling came from a 25-year-old body on a perfect bike compared to a 35 or whatever, you know. So Dovi's old, Dovi's got a style, and Dovi's not about to change. Arguably, I mean, this is where Rossi is phenomenal. Rossi has changed his style, but maybe this one is a step too far. I mean, you know, Rossi is racing's Madonna. Every time something new comes along, he sort of watches how it works, and then he learns how to do it better. but there is a limit, and I have a feeling 41, 42 is round about the limit. Your body naturally does things differently. But chassis also makes a difference. It is not surprising that Suzuki did so well because they have concentrated on handling. They've concentrated on throttle control and the ability of the bike to do exactly what the rider wants ever since they came back. You know, the engine is part of the handling package. Yamaha have the same concept. Other factories have engine people and chassis people. But at Suzuki, they're the same people. The way the engine works is part of the handling. They have been working, nibbling away at the edges of this deal, of their bike, for the last 5 years. 2 years ago, they made a big mistake with their crankshaft. I'll call it weight, but it's crankshaft inertia. The engine rules mean that you can't keep changing the crankshaft weight if you've won a couple of races. They had won some races, the engine design was frozen, and they did the wrong thing. So they had a year, a whole year, with an engine that wouldn't do what they wanted it to do. Once they got that sorted, they've just added 2 or 3 horsepower, see how it works out, add 2 or 3 horsepower, see how it works out. You don't want to add 20 horsepower. If you add 20 horsepower, you've got a very different motorcycle. So this is a game of little dolly steps, little, and the guy that's now running the project, Shinichi Sahara, he was the race engineer on the GSVR, so the old V4. He knows this game. He hasn't got it ahead of itself. He hasn't let it get behind itself. But he's also been given the budget to gradually increase their engine power. And it's paid off. They got everything came together just perfectly for them. And they understood. I mean, they had an excellent test team led by Tom O'Kane. Really, really good rider in Ginterly. They, from that test team, understood what to do to their chassis to get the best out of that tyre. So you had this project that's been building and building and building and building, and then a big problem comes in for everybody else, and suddenly Suzuki is seen for what it is, a very, very good motorcycle.
But the one problem they have still is their ability to do good qualifying laps. Is it easy to explain why this happened to them?
It's not easy, but it is linked to the way it works in a racetrack, in a race. The suspension on a motorcycle and on a street motorcycle are your forks and your rear shock going up and down. And that is what matters more than anything else all the way till you go over about 45 degrees. Then you have to start looking at the bike in a different way. Instead of the suspension holding the bike up, you have to think of the front and the rear wheel as somebody doing press-ups, left and right hand. And instead of holding it up, you're looking at the tires as being pushed away. And you have to push them away exactly the right amount. So take your person doing press-ups. Now imagine doing those same press-ups on a slippery bathroom floor. On a racetrack, you're desperately trying to hold everything in the right place and push it away. Also, at full lean, the suspension's pointing in the wrong direction. If you hit a 5mm bump, the suspension is not going to move 5mm. It's going to try and move sideways a bit more than that. But it's then bending and it's got all sorts of problems. What they have discovered, the discovery goes back really to the mid-90s, is you can make a motorcycle too stiff. For street use, you can be almost as stiff as you like. And in fact, the stiffer the bike is, the lighter and easier it feels. But on a race bike, once you're over 45 degrees, you need the chassis to flex to give you suspension. So the only suspension you have, I mean, we're now up, unbelievably, to 63 and 64 degrees. These are phenomenal lean angles. I mean, a motorcycle's got more in common with an aircraft with its wings sawn off than it has with a car. And when you lean over, when you get to 60 degrees, just like an aircraft, if you speak to anybody that's ever learned to fly, they'll be thinking, oh, crikey, what's the load on the wings? Because at 60 degrees, actually, it's double gravity trying to rip the wings off. Well, leaned over a motorcycle is double weight being pushed down through those tyres. So not only are you now doing press-ups on a slippery bathroom floor, but you've got your girlfriend or your boyfriend standing on your shoulders. This is getting very, very complicated. But you've then got to have some bend in the chassis. And getting that bend right is absolutely fundamental. And the people who understand that are the people who manage to build bikes that worked with this new rear tire first. The people who didn't are the ones that are lagging behind.
So where do the chassis or forks or swing arm need to flex then? How can you find out about these things?
Well, I wrote a lot about it in the book, but in the end, the Japanese have this wonderful expression: it must bend like a tree. They want everything to bend a little bit. So Yamaha have wheel spacers in a specific position inside the wheel. And then they have little spacers that fit in that the axle run in. Those little spacers that fit in come in varying lengths. So they can choose to let the wheel deflect a little bit more on the axle. It's not loose, it's physically bending, but they can make it stiffer or not so stiff. If you look at the bottom of the fork legs, some bikes haven't got an awful lot of metal, some do. People are designing in the ability to bend a little bit. When you go up through the fork leg is tapered. Some of it is designed to flex. You get to the top triple clamp. Some bikes have three bolts, sorry, the bottom triple clamp, so the what's holding the fork legs in position. Some bikes have three bolts, some bikes have two. We went through a period at the start of MotoGP where everybody turned up with three bolts, and within about 2 years, the middle bolt was always left out. If you go to the stiffer chassis, you'll find that those bolts are done up to a much lower torque level. It's just a little bit everywhere. But the line about which everything bends is what's called the neutral line. So there's the, as a motorbike turns, it's a little bit like a hobby horse. Yeah, a child with his little horse head and the stick sticking out through the back. And if you're going to turn right into a corner, you turn the handlebars left and the bike falls over. On the street, the tire stays pretty much where it is and the bike falls to the inside of the corner. But it doesn't fall over front and rear wheel the same. It rolls about this line. So you've turned the handlebars to the left, and that's like turning the ears on the hobby horse, and it rolls on the line of the stick. So there's a line from the lower triple clamp, from the bottom bearing all the way to the rear tire contact patch, and that's what the bike falls over on. And you want the bike to bend more or less at 90 degrees to that. So it's bending, but on that line, not a lot of bending. Although they tell me they do want a little bit, but nobody will talk about amounts. You can get people to discuss the concept of chassis flex, and I've dug in far enough. We call this line, it's either the neutral line, the rear trail line, or the twist axis. They're all the same line. Very close to the same line. And you can just about get people to talk about that, but you cannot get anybody to tell you by how much. All I know is things bend a little bit. But you can quickly work out who's got the problem. So let's go back to Suzuki. Their bike clearly flexes quite a lot. And at the end of the race, it's going just as fast as it is at the beginning of the race. It's preserved its tires perfectly. So when it's leaned over, the bend is allowing the tire to survive. If you are too stiff, the tire is forced into the ground too hard and it wears. And it wears sufficiently to destroy the rubber. If you have a bit more flex, you squash the tire a bit like a balloon. It's a bit bigger, but it doesn't wear too badly. If you want to do one lap fast, you want the tire to grip like crazy and be forced into the track, and you don't care about where. But if you want to be going fast at the end of the race, you've got to be a lot nicer. So I would say Suzuki have got a chassis that works for the race, but that same chassis is struggling to put enough pressure on the tire in qualifying. Whereas somebody like Ducati is the exact opposite.
But can Suzuki do something about it? Stiff the chassis up before the qualifying and then take it off before the race?
They probably could do, but then you've got the rider with a bike that feels slightly different.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's not impossible. One bike on the grid has adjustable stiffness. If you look at the back of the main beam on the Ducati, down by the rider's ankle, there's four holes. And behind it, on the inside of the bike, there's a plate. And they put bolts through there, and they can choose to do them very stiff or not so stiff. They can have a thin plate or a thick plate or no plate. Most of the year, they ran without any plate at all. But in testing, they were running plates. So yes, you could choose to put a plate there. At one point, Ducati had something similar up at the front as well. The question is, you've got to send the rider out. He's got used to the bike. Can he actually mentally do that 1 second quicker?
Yeah,
you know, how many times is he going to come back in a dump truck, you know?
Yeah, now it's so tight. So even 2/10, 3/10, it's enough to get pole position or to miss Q2.
Yes. I think what's probably happening now is that Suzuki are just fine-tuning the chassis and trying to work out... There's a thing called the 80-20 rule. You try to gain 80% by only losing 20%. And somewhere in the Suzuki chassis, they're trying to lose just 20% to get 80% better qualifying performance. But it will probably mean the last two laps are not as fast. You know what I mean? But if it's only the last two laps, they can deal with it. If it's the last five laps, maybe they can't.
And what do you say about the Suzuki engine? Do they need to improve it to next year or to this year? Or is they happy enough with the performance of the engine?
Well, I mean, they can't change it. The rules have been changed, so the engine design has to be the same. They're in a very sweet spot. And one thing you quickly learn about motorbike racing is it's incredibly difficult to find the sweet spot and incredibly easy to move outside it. So, yes, they might be looking for one or two horsepower, but I suspect they're not looking for 10.
Yeah.
It would be so easy to mess this up. You know, you watch a Japanese factory, and there's no two ways about it. The Japanese understand this game better than anybody else. They get to a point where everything's just so, and development stops stone dead. They're happy just to play with the settings for the rider. And, you know, the bike may not be perfect on every racetrack, but as long as it's perfect on 80% of them, that's fine. Absolutely fine.
And what do you think about the riders in Suzuki, Rins and Mir? Mir won this year, Rins was third. Do you think Rins will beat Mir, or will Mir still be the fastest one?
When you watch riders come up, and I'm not the world's expert on rider training or watching a rider's development, but all the people I know who do it as a job talk about watching the rate at which a rider learns and the speed with which he adds speed. You know, you've got data guys who will tell you about a rider being able to use the throttle and the brake together and things like that. But in the end, it's how the sum total works up. Who's on what development path? And it was clear at the end of last year that Mir was getting better quicker than Rins was getting better. And then at the start of the year, it didn't hurt that Rins got hurt. You know, that's definitely messed up his year.
And, when you speak also about inline fours here, we know Suzuki got the world championship, and also Yamaha were in a good position because they had a lot of victories this year, but still a lot of problems with the engine. What do you know about their engine problems in Yamaha?
Okay, well, something went wrong. I mean, this goes back, I think, a couple of years. The guy who built the current type of Yamaha engine, the guy who designed it and put it together, is called Kyoichi Tsuji. And Tsuji-san was Yamaha's man in Formula One in the late 90s. In fact, he lived in Britain for about 6 years. He can swear in English better than I can. he was actually based in the country, in the town I was born in the Midlands, in Rugby. But he understood that engine backwards. He's the one that put the packaging together, because it's an incredibly small engine. They have a rearward rotating crankshaft. They have a shaft that goes across the engine to drive the clutch. That, on his version of the engine, that gear drive off the center of the crankshaft was also then modified to take the gear drive to the cams. You know, everything that can be in the middle is in the middle. The only thing that's wide about it is the outside cylinders, and they've done everything they can to reduce the problem that brings. But he understood that motor backwards, and he basically, middle of last year, went off to a new job, outboard engines, I believe. Come to the end of this year, they've repackaged the motor. I believe they probably wanted a slightly different gearbox. I'm fairly sure that you could have put a 2019 engine in a 2004 chassis. You know, they did not change the fundamental external profile of the engine. They changed lots of other things, but I'm fairly sure those points were the same. This year, I have a suspicion the engine mounting point's in a different position, because it's the only thing explaining technically why the factory didn't go back to their old chassis. Because when they stopped last year, I mean, they had enough chassis to race at Valencia. They didn't disappear overnight. They're all sitting in a shed somewhere in Japan doing nothing. They could have been brought back. The problem is that that new chassis that Yamaha had needed a new air intake, which was a new front half of the chassis because it was a bigger hole through the middle. It had a new fuel tank and a new seat. That's different mounting positions. So you change the chassis, you change the whole motorcycle. But anyway, back to the engine. I think that when they got everything ready for this year, one of the really small bits of the rules is you can't change anything. If you go to a new manufacturer to say, please build me a valve, he's going to build it his way. He's going to build it with his version of the heat treatment, his version of the plating, his version of the corners on the holes inside the valve. Yeah, because the valves are all hollow. Some of them are gas filled. I don't know whether these ones are. You know, what type of gas? It's not going to be identical. And whatever they did was, when they realized they needed extra valves and that the old manufacturer wouldn't supply, it might have been a COVID problem, it might have been a materials problem, it might have been COVID stopping the material. You know, it could be anything in this crazy world of ours. They went to someone else and said, build us some of those valves. And that was a jump in the rule book, because you can read the rule book to say you could go to two manufacturers and get the same thing. But clearly, in this case, they ended up with something different. And I don't think for one second anybody had cheating at the front of their mind. You know, an exhaust valve is not, or a valve is not going to make that much difference. If you're going to cheat in this game, you're going to do something that gets you a bunch of time, not tiny little bits. So for me, somebody misunderstood the severity of the rule. And the severity of the rule is you get all your valves from the same guy making them the same way. The engines with the new valves failed. I think the heads dropped off the exhaust valves, because the exhaust valves get the worst, hardest job. Whereas it's quite obvious that the engines they had with the older valves lasted. I mean, Morbidelli, you know, they had 5 engines for 15 races. So that's an implied 3 engines per race. Morbidelli did 6 races per engine. And he nearly won a couple of the last 2 races. That is phenomenal. That's double engine life. And to get that engine life, you'll have made the ignition a little bit less aggressive. You'll have added a bit more fuel. You'll have been a bit nicer to the rev limit. So it wasn't an engine at its limit, yet he was still nearly winning races. So on the basis that Yamaha's next year are going to be all built with the good valves, because that's the one that was homologated. So, you know, they haven't really shot their foot off. They could have, if they'd ended up homologating one with the bad valves,
exactly,
might have to run them all next year.
Yeah. Just one question there, because Morbidelli had an engine failure in race number 2 in Jerez.
Yes.
But they just used the first engine when the failure was in the valves in the first race. Then they took that away. They ate engines away and then new engines to the second Jerez race. But why did Morbidelli's bike fail in that race?
This is one of the things where experience comes in. The first problem was having the valves, different valves in there in the first place. The second thing is having a failure and not stopping dead and doing something about it right now. Mm-hmm. They went into the next race with the same valves. All of the engines that were used in those two first races were then parked and never used again or had blown up. Two or three of them were tried in free practice one and two at Austria, where it all kind of went wrong because Yamaha decided they were going to run out of engine life and needed to use a bit more power. So they basically said to everybody, we've got a problem with the valves. We need to change them. And everybody turned around and said, well, you've won two races. You know, it's not like you're slow. But clearly, and I have no proof of this, however, logic says, someone said, if you have three engines, you know, because Morbidelli had two engines retired and a third engine blown up, if you have engines that fail that quickly, how come the other ones are lasting so long?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really when it all went wrong, because logically, something's different.
Yeah.
You know... And it doesn't matter what it is, but the rule says you can't change anything. So therefore, ipso facto, you have done something different. So, yeah, it all kind of unraveled a bit quick after that. But don't take it away from Morbidelli. You know, let's just rattle through the pressures on him. He didn't get the latest bike. It was clear that as much as he didn't have the latest bike, I'm fairly sure the engine has the same components inside it, although possibly he has the earlier crankcases.
So the valves is the same in Morbidelli's 19 bike as the factory 20 bikes?
Yes. I mean, you just would, because there was no restriction on them having a new engine, and if you could bolt the same cylinder head on, you wouldn't have two designs of cylinder head unless you had to.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. But he came out, so he's been basically told he's not good enough to have one of the top three bikes. Mm-hmm. Then it turns out that whatever they did to the chassis didn't like the tires quite so much. And they've got to work out what that is. They have the benefit, though, of knowing that whatever Morbidelli's chassis is doing is right. So now they've got to make new chassis with the different headstock for the different air intake and the different mounting points for the different seat and different mounting points for the different fuel tank work the same as the old one. Whatever they did, whatever little change they did that probably came with the lines of, I know, it's a great idea, why don't we do this because we go a bit faster, was the wrong thing. So don't do that, go back. So they at least have the answer sitting in their own garage. But Morbidelli was told he wasn't good enough to get the latest stuff, so he's fairly well motivated to prove a point. But so is his crew. His crew chief was Maverick Vignale's crew chief. He's the oldest crew chief in Yamaha now. He's the one with all the experience. He's the one that knows when you get to a new track like Portimao that you treat it in a certain way and you try this, you try that, but you don't get too inventive.
And three world titles with Lorenzo.
Yes. You know, he knows what he's doing. But he's also been told he's not good enough for the Tops team. You're talking about two guys with a major point to prove and a bike that's maybe just that little bit better, but they were winning races with six race old engines. It's just absolutely incredible. At Aragon, the slowest bike on the racetrack was Morbidelli's Yamaha, and he won.
Yeah.
You know, I hear some TV commentators, I hope not you, always screaming, oh, the bike's not fast enough, the bike, look at the top speeds. Top speed happens once a lap. It's the rest of the lap that actually matters. Mm-hmm. You know, top speed is an advertising slogan. It means absolutely nothing. Unless they give 5 points for the fastest bike, forget it. Morbidelli's bike won at Aragon. It's fantastic. And that was with a 5-race-old engine.
Yeah. So, and what do you think of this year with Morbidelli's bike? He is still running the non-factory if you say it like that. He will have three bikes that is better.
Yeah, well, I think they'll make the factory bikes better. There's no restriction on chassis re-engineering. There's restrictions on pretty much everything else. But the one bit that's, well, the two bits that are broken, one bit they just forget the new bits and go back to the old bits, make sure all the engines are built with them, and spend whatever money's necessary to make that happen. And the second thing is make the new chassis work exactly like the old chassis. Do that, you've got three fast works bikes. Morbidelli, though, you know, it might be a year old, but it ain't going to be any slower.
Not you slower know, than last year.
And he still has a point to prove. So I actually think the biggest shock next year is going to be how fast the Yamahas go.
Yeah.
Because this year they've done everything they've done with one hand tied behind their back.
Yeah, and they won half of the races.
Yeah.
If they can just go up a little bit from the low points, they will be there in the championship.
Yes. I mean, it's quite clear that their new factory chassis quite likes flowing tracks. But the second you bring in stop and go, it doesn't like it at all. And they did this a few years ago. Maybe about 3 years ago now, they had Tech 3 as the number two team and Folger as the number two rider in there. Yeah, Zarco's the number one rider. Zarco's running a slightly different chassis that he used all the time there. It was a Lorenzo chassis. But Folger had the previous year's work chassis. And at Valencia, right at the end of the year, Yamaha's won at Phillip Island because their new bike has worked so well on the swoops. And they turn up at Valencia, they were down in 15th. And on Saturday night, they walked into Tech 3, swiped back all the old work chassis, built the bikes up with them. And their first practice session on the bike they were going to be raced was in warm-up the next morning. Now, and it, you know, that's not long enough. But they should have done that at the start of the weekend. I mean, if there's one thing I will do to say, because I don't actually regard the chassis problem, maybe hasn't been managed particularly well, but the valve thing was an inexperience problem.
Mm-hmm.
But there is definitely something wrong with the decision making in Yamaha, where the guys on the ground won't take big decisions. So they waited till Saturday night with the Valencia chassis problem 3 years ago. Somebody should have grabbed that by the lapels hard Friday lunchtime, and Friday night that should have happened. 10 years before, Ben Spies is at Assen on the number two works Yamaha, and it's clear the chassis's not working. And Masao Furusawa, who had by then retired, is in Europe on holiday, and he turns up at Assen with his wife, and he's there as the guest. And it's clearly at some point on the Thursday afternoon, he said, "So what's the problem with the bike? Oh, it doesn't do this very well." Huh. Didn't do that last year. No, Tech 3's got the old chassis. Well, why haven't you fitted it then? So Ben Spies won at Assen all those years ago on a year-old chassis they'd swiped back from Tech 3 on the Thursday. But it took a retired super senior manager on the ground to say, "Oi, get on with it." And you just see it. You know, when it's happened once or twice, you start thinking, this is part of the culture of Yamaha. They are trained not to change things, because by changing things too much, things go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But when you change something and it goes wrong, you do need to find reverse gear. And it's a question of when you find it. You can leave it too late. But they went back and Spies won the race.
Yeah, but the factory riders this year will be Vinales and Quartararo. And they had very up and down the last season. Quartararo won three races, but also very low points with out of the points in Aragon, for example, and Vinales also very up and down. How do you see their performance this year?
Okay, I'm not the rider man. I just, how can I put it? I don't think either of them performed as well as they should have. I think they're paid factory money and Yamaha didn't get its money's worth. If you're buying a factory rider, you expect him to always try at his limit. You expect him to work out the risks and manage those risks. You don't expect him to suddenly decide the bike feels funny there is a point where you've got to push it even though you don't like it. And very specifically, when the man from Brembo walks in the front of the garage and says, we don't think our normal brakes are going to be okay at this racetrack, you listen to him. You don't sit there and say, well, I don't like the feel of the brakes that will last. The bloke from Brembo walked into Yamaha and said, our brakes have got a problem at the end of the main straight at A1 ring. He isn't going to put his company's reputation on the line to say that because there's no problem. Mm-hmm. He's been through every possible alternative before he said that. Yet they put a bloke out on the old brakes that Brembo's, you know, and then they got all upset when he crashed. That's not professional. Mm-hmm. And that is intended as proper criticism of Vinales and his side of the garage, I'm afraid. That was crazy.
Yeah.
I hope the lesson's been learned.
Hopefully.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Spoke about Lorenzo before, and you mentioned him as well, Neil. Lorenzo and his ability to develop bikes and to ride quick. You told me, Andreas, about some connections with the riders that has been going fast with his old bikes. You mentioned Sarko, you mentioned Quartararo. Is there a connection between it?
Yeah, there's one particular chassis. Lorenzo's last year, Yamaha built a chassis with some extra metal welded on. When we were talking about how the bike works leaned over, we mentioned the thing called the twist axis. If you imagine holding a softback book and bending it. If you bend that book, it bends gently over the whole length of the book. If I put a bulldog clip, a paper clip, big paper clip on the back of the book and bend it, the bend moves towards the stiff bit. Now, if that was a chassis and you put some metal on the top of the top beam and then you lean the bike over and you want it to bend, it'll actually bend more. It's softer leaned over rather than harder. Even though you put more metal on it, it may also be a little bit stiffer under braking. But you've had two effects. Yamaha had one chassis with an extra plate welded on the top, and then Lorenzo liked it, and he had both of his bikes like that. And when he left, I thought, that's the end of that. Zarco turns up, they plonk him down in the number one seat in Tech 3 and said, here's all the last year's stuff, which do you like? And he got through to this special chassis and thought, I like that. And he stuck with it. At the end of that year, they asked him again, you've got choice of all these. In fact, because you went so well, you can have one of the new ones as well. Now he said, I'm sticking with that. And he kept all of Zarco's career was on one pair of chassis with one spare. And when Zarco left, I thought, well, that's the end of Lorenzo's last bike. You know, I mean, it's phenomenal. This is a racing chassis. This is supposedly new every year stuff. And here's a 3-year-old one. Very nearly winning races. So I walked up the pit lane a couple of years ago in Malaysia, and there's Quartararo trying out his new bike, and I looked at the chassis and there's the plate on top. So Quartararo had that same chassis. What it means is there's something it gives them, because Rossi doesn't like that chassis. Mm-hmm. When Vinales first tried it, he didn't like that chassis. Halfway through last year, Vinales threw his toys out the pram at Assen because he's being beaten by Quartararo and he doesn't like it, and says, what's Quartararo got I haven't got? And Yamaha go through the list and there's this chassis. So on Thursday afternoon at Assen, the works team walks into Tech 3. Can we have this chassis back? Oh, sorry, into then Sepang Racing. Mm-hmm. Can we have this, Petronas, can we have this chassis back? And overnight, Quartararo was very lucky and got promoted to full work chassis. And Vinales got the chassis with the welded plate back on. And he won Assen with it and then did the next two races. And after that, it disappeared. And I think that's been untested and they're trying to duplicate that chassis. But there is something really small and really fundamental about the way that chassis works differently. But that raced for 4 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that should not be possible. You know, the type of aluminium they use in race chassis and things isn't designed to last 4 years. So it's great.
But after that, Quartararo last year, or 2 years ago, 2019, he still was competing in... Yeah, he took second places after Marquez with the factory chassis then.
He did, but by then he should be almost, because he'd learnt that much. But his initial stuff was on this other chassis. Yeah. I think there's a group of riders, Lorenzo, Zarco, Quartararo, Cal Crutchlow when he's of a mind, because when he was in Yamaha, he basically rode the bike pretty much the same way Lorenzo is. I think Cal Crutchlow is massively misunderstood because he's managed to ride three types of factory bike in the same way as the number one rider. That's incredible. He's changed his style enough to match what the bike will do. Now, he's not quite to the level, say, of Stoner, who could work out what was different about a bike and do something different by the second corner. You know, but Cal's pretty impressive on that one. But I think those guys ride a bike particularly smoothly, very carefully on the edge. I mean, look at what Zarco did. A1 ring? No, Bruneau. When he got the...
Long lap penalty. Yeah.
Just think about that for a minute. It's on a dirty bit of track. It's on the outside of the corner. He's on for a podium and he's not going to lose it. And he went through that and lost... You know, everybody says the long lap's supposed to lose you 3 seconds, and he lost one.
Yeah.
Just unbelievable. But that's a different skill to what Marquez has got.
Yeah.
You know, it's smooth and gentle, and it requires a different sort of motorbike. And I think when factories hire riders, they've got to understand what they're trying to achieve. Because KTM clearly did not understand what they were hiring when they hired Zarco. But Ducati absolutely understood when they took him back. Because the bike they gave him, the 2019 bike, is also an ex-Lorenzo design.
Yeah. So do you think he will keep, if we go into Ducati now, do you think he will...
have to breathe.
How can I put this delicately? If you have sensible management, yes. But if you have somebody who's going to say, no, we must use the latest, you've just shot both feet off.
Yeah, because he's promoted now to the Pramac team. And
yes.
Yeah, let's see which bike
let's
he
hope
uses.
He takes his, yes, well, hopefully he takes his chassis and his race engineer with him. One thing is worth noting is race engineer was a chap who went to Suzuki with Iannone. It was Iannone's engineer. He has clearly had a massive experience of dealing with a difficult sort of rider. He's perfect for Zarco. You know, it's just great when you watch a plan come together. And that penalty trip was a plan coming together.
And it was for a podium.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah. It was impressive. We were speaking about it a lot in the race and gave him a lot of credit for that corner. For the ride. Mm. All right, so Neil, we're now into the V4s. We started this podcast with mentioning the difference differences between V4 and inline fours, and you spoke about the braking zone and everything. And how about Ducati this year then? They have had different riders on the podiums. Almost everyone has been on the podium, but still they have had big problems with their top name, Andrea Dovizioso.
Yeah, I think that Andrea, I think we've also touched on, really, in the end he has a style.
Yeah.
And he's taken that style to the ultimate level he possibly could. And then somebody changed something that's meant he couldn't do it. And it's bitten him. I actually think he's retired. He just hasn't found the right way to put it in words yet.
Yeah, probably. You don't think he will be back?
Everybody says he could go to Honda if Marquez doesn't come back. But everybody who says that has forgotten that Honda were forced to run three riders in a team 1 year because they wanted to put him in the number two team. And his manager, really nice guy, said, cough, cough, contract says he's a works ride. As much as Honda, I think, were in the wrong, they did stand by their contract and we had three works bikes, but that must have cost them quite a lot of money. And I think it's unlikely they will have forgotten the experience. So I don't think probably he's going back to Honda.
No. Let's see.
But the other riders then, except Dovizioso, they found some good pace in different places during the year.
Yeah, well, this is where Ducati and KTM, I think, have some things in common. It's noticeable that Ducati were really, really fast at Misano. Nearly won the race. But that's one of their two test tracks. You know, their guys know that track better than anything. So it's, to me, it's not surprising. You have a good machine, but not quite the top level. But you have a good rider who is nearly top level. Then you go to his home track, or certainly a place that he's been riding for the last 10 years. It's going to make the difference. So for me, I look at the Misano result and say that's reside that, or the result that could have been if the bike hadn't failed. I think the Misano run was down to the rider, and the other runs are just occasional runs where everybody got things almost right. But compared to Honda, and we need to bring Honda in here. I mean, Honda started the year with a group of bikes that were all designed for Marquez, for Marc Marquez, and for his style. And everybody else's job was to learn to ride like Marc Marquez. He's then out of the loop. Alex is dropped in the deep end. Cal is trying to do what he can. And they sit down, they have a long, long, long chat. And they work out that they've got a good Japanese rider that with a bit of help can get up a level. Nakagami. And they start working with Nakagami. And then by Misano, suddenly Alex Marquez is there too. And it's not until you look very, very carefully at the pictures you realize they had a new chassis. And that's telling you a bunch of stuff. It means Honda understood what they had built for Marc Marquez, and they understood what to do if they were not building for Marc Marquez, because it probably takes you 2 months, 3 months from the shock of Marc not being there to actually, you know, they to turn up at Valencia, at Misano with it. They've done it about as fast as you can build a chassis.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever they did, weight distribution, stiffness, I suspect both, suddenly, Alex Marquez is riding the Honda a bit more like a works Yamaha, only it's got Honda power. You watch his lines, you watch the way he's riding. He's not standing it on its nose. He's not drifting into corners. It's tracking just like an inline four. So they absolutely understood what to do. That is an expression of design experience and maturity and knowledge that nobody else clearly possesses. Because Ducati could not do it.
But why haven't they done it before? Because they have big problems in 2019 with Lorenzo, even with Nakagami and Crutchlow.
I think the nature of the way Honda think is we build one bike.
Yeah.
And then we try and go for it. It's up to the other riders to learn how to ride like Marquez. So they were interested in Lorenzo more from the perspective of could we get him to ride like Marquez more than to build a... I thought they wanted him to build a bike that like the Yamaha. And it is quite possible that some of the things they learnt is what's sitting inside Alex Marquez's bike now. But they didn't actually bring it for George. They certainly on the racetrack, they wanted him to ride a bike like Marquez. I had a chat with one of the guys there and said, yeah, we decided to go for him because with the Ducati, he was showing that much more aggression. So Lorenzo, second year Ducati, was a more aggressive rider than the ex-Yamaha rider the year before. And that's what Honda was after. And that's what Honda wanted him to do. And that's where he couldn't go.
Yeah.
So that, to me, then was a collision exactly the same as Zarco going to KTM.
Mm-hmm. But this year, when Marquez coming back, if he's coming back, but probably he will, maybe not in the beginning of the season, but in the middle of the season, do you think he will have a problem then? Or will they just go back to the start of 2020 with his bike? Or will he use the bike that is developed now for Alex Marquez or Paul Espargaro?
I think they'll probably put him on both and they'll put him on whatever he wants. Yeah, I mean, the one thing that's not frozen in the design regs next year is the chassis.
Yeah.
So they can run whatever they like.
So he will not have a problem with the bike, you think?
No.
No.
No. I mean, either he gets his old bike, and, you know, they swap chassis halfway through the year. So somewhere there are half a dozen chassis sitting in a shipping container getting dusty. So he can crash them till the cows come home. And the
or
riders,
Paul Espargaro, you don't know.
Well, it'd be interesting to see which one Paul goes for, because Paul's riding style is quite Marquez-like.
Yeah.
But whether it's extreme enough, I don't know. I mean, I'm never sure. Let's just think about Lorenzo. When Lorenzo went to Honda, not only did Honda get someone to experiment with on their riding, but Ducati didn't have him.
Yeah.
So for their money, they got a load of engineering experience and their engineers learnt some more. But also their major problem, Ducati, got a big problem. And KTM's coming up and suddenly Honda buy Espargaro. Now, Paul, I'm absolutely sure, sees it. I've got this fantastic chance to ride a Honda. I'm going to Honda. But if I was the man with a checkbook at Honda, where's the most effective place to spend my money? And at the time they signed Paul, it's probably by slowing down KTM. So we will see, you know.
Like exactly as you said with Lorenzo, because Lorenzo could have been a big threat against Marquez in 2019 on the Ducati.
Yeah. Yeah. But a bit like Andrea's about to discover that if you go away from racing for a while, you get slow quickly. And I think Jorge has already found that, you know, and the factories have rumbled him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Do you think Mark Marquez will find out about that? Or do you think he will be on the same level as when he left?
He cannot be on the same level. I mean, he's got muscles to build up, reaction times to fine down. He's never been away from a racing bike in his, you know, since he was 8 years old for this long. Probably younger. So I think Marquez is, you know, hopefully won't hurt himself in the process. He's got to have to come back and learn how to go fast again.
Mm-hmm.
But still then, Ducati has had problems. Will they be able to solve it with Miller and Bagnaia in the factory team this year? Because you cannot do that much. The engine is frozen, but still the chassis is possible to work with. But we know also they have had some management problems before coming to linking the factory and the people on the floor, on the racetracks together, and the information system and everything. Is everything in place behind the scenes?
I think everything is in place, But Honda could solve the problem of this year's tyre for Alex, and Ducati could not solve this year's tyre for Andrea. So there is a difference to the depth of knowledge and the depth of understanding. You know, that chassis for Marquez that let a first-year MotoGP rider get on podiums on what was previously the most difficult-to-ride bike in the paddock is exceptional. Yeah. As a demonstration of engineering nous, it is brilliant. But it shows everybody else up because they couldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, let's think of KTM now, you know. They won a race. I am so pleased for Brad Binder, it's not true. I've watched that lad come through all the way, and he's just fantastic. But he won at a track where he had been allowed to have a 2 or 3 day testing session before the race series got there. So they got settings. He'd learnt the track. He understood the bike. It is to his massive credit that he could actually win the race. Let's not take that away. But for the KTM to let him win the race, they needed those extra days of testing. The other place where he could have been quick was the A1 ring, but he couldn't do the test there because he was stuck in South Africa.
Yeah.
But Paul could do well. So the bike was good. It's just that Brad needed more time to learn. You look at the race victories. They did a test at A1 ring. They won at the A1 ring. They did a test at Brno. They won at Brno. The other place they won was in Portugal. A track that has not been used and which hardly any riders knew their way around except for one guy.
And he won.
And he won. So the KTM is so close to being good. You know, it really is there. But it is still one step behind. It needs that extra bit of luck, that extra bit of experience, that extra bit of knowledge to get it on the top level. But it's coming. What they must also remember now is that the time for big changes in design is over. The thing that will take them the next bit is tiny. You know, it might be flex, it might be great center of gravity, it might be doing absolutely nothing and just getting the electronics better.
Mm-hmm.
And the test riders at KTM then with Pedrosa and with Callio, important, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Callio's done a fantastic job, but I think without a doubt, Pedrosa's ability to come back and tell them what it's doing is fantastic. But don't forget, they've not only got Pedrosa, but they've got a top Erlins technician, and they've got Pete Benson from Mark VDS, who was Nicky Hayden's crew chief. There's a massive pile of knowledge suddenly been added. You know, a lot of the knowledge before this year came from Yamaha experience because they had, you know, a working thing with Tech 3. But now they've had another jolt of, let's call it Honda knowledge, and they've landed the resulting design. I mean, the chassis is superb. You know, they've had to develop, with aluminium, which is the material of choice for most of the businesses at racing, and for their street bikes, it's relatively easy to weld. It's relatively easy to change the flexibility. But you can't do complicated 3D printed parts with the aluminium. Whereas with steel, which is what KTM is using, you can. They have undoubtedly had to perfect some new technologies. I believe Pankel is doing a lot of the work for them. But you know, you've got 3D parts, 3D printed parts in that chassis that are fundamental to the way it's working. So this is a whole new technology, and it is now possible. Where they were the ones before, where you thought, why are they with steel and everybody else is on aluminium? You could actually put together an argument that steel is better than aluminium now. It's just they need to finish the job. Considering how far behind KTM were, it is fantastic that they've got to this level. Because this has not been easy. You know, they made themselves a very, very difficult path to do their own suspension company and to do a steel chassis. And they're winning races. It's fantastic.
They do. Hopefully they will continue with it.
Yeah, we've had
absolutely.
Two good riders.
Yeah, of course. And this year, then, Neil, what do you hope for? What do you wish for? Or how do I put it? What do you think will happen during the season? Is it possible to predict anything?
To be honest, no, because the one bit that's a problem is the tire, and the one bit you need to work with to change that is the chassis, and that is open. All the factories are fighting the same COVID-related problems. I think we're in for another amazing year, because I don't. Whenever Mark comes back, he's not coming back at 100%. And as we've seen this year, there's an awful lot of guys who reckon that without Mark there, they're the man. So I think we're in for another absolutely storming year. And there's two things. One is I would now expect KTM to do even better. And I think Yamaha are going to come out fighting. Yeah. I think Yamaha properly going to be good.
And is it any of the riders you want to mention specially for the coming year?
I just want to see Brad Binder win the thing. Because it's fantastic. I can remember him coming to Silverstone to a British Superbike Moto 3 race, and there'd been a misunderstanding. They thought there was no minimum weight, and at that time, we had a minimum weight requirement regardless of the weight of the rider. So he turned up and they had to add weight, and he had, I think they went to about 5 tire shops and took all their tire balancing weights. The entire bike was covered in tire balance weights to get it heavier, as was his back protector. And he learned to ride it. Now, he did crash in the race, and I'm sure it was the weight, and two things have come from that. Brad learned a lot, and BSB now have a maximum amount of added weight so that a small rider is not required to ride a stupidly heavy bike. But yes, I just, he's fought his way up, and Brad is one of those people, when it's going wrong, he digs deep. And this is my criticism of Quartararo and Vinales coming out. When it's going wrong, they're not digging deep. Brad Binder got put on the back row of the grid at Jerez a few years ago and won the race.
His first race.
He didn't give up. Yes. He didn't give up. He came out fighting. And I think that's the final key for all this wonderful design, great skill, everything else. In the end, you need a fighter.
Yeah, and he also fought the half of the year with the Moto 2 chassis as well.
Yes.
That was not good.
Yes.
Yeah,
very painful experience for everybody concerned. That I'm sure, But yes, I mean, the WP technician for that works squad, that works KTM squad, Damian Bailey, who actually just lives not so far from me, is now Jake Dixon's crew chief in the Sepang team. And you look at Jake's performance last year compared to his performance this year. So many people learned a lot in that team, in that KTM team last year, to come out and then say to Jake, who was clearly struggling with one or two things, and they fixed the bike for him. And, and apart from the unfortunate injury at the end, he was going unbelievably well.
Yeah, in Le Mans, it was just a couple of laps to the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was close. Very, very close.
Yeah.
I have one question about Marc Márquez. What's your take on it?
The human body is not something you can throw away and just replace. So maybe it deserved a bit more respect than it was given. He had a bad injury, one that's noted, in the past has finished people's injuries. Carl Fogarty's injury was not so different. Yet he was back a week later. You have to put question marks on that. But I was not there. I'm not a medical man. But you just sit and, what I was in a previous life was a risk manager. And that was a risk that was not worth taking. you know, it was fanfared at the time, Brave and everything else. Yes, but there's a difference between brave and foolish. You know, so yeah, I don't think it's so good.
We haven't mentioned Aprilia.
I had so much hopes for them. I interviewed them at Sepang. They were bubbling. They got the engine right, you know, and it was a weight distribution thing, not just a power thing. Then in the last test before the season started, they blew an engine up. And they did all the right things. They turned up for the first race with a detuned engine, made sure it finished the race. But clearly it's still not quite right. And they fought to look after Iannone, or they fought to let Iannone have an appeal. Yet they turned up for that legal case. I think the expression from the movie world is they turned up with a knife to a gunfight. they didn't think it through. If you're going to support Iannone, you should have at least made sure his lawyers and he had an argument that was going to stand up. I mean, three quarters of the judgment against him was criticizing his appeal, saying it was just not, you know, just absolutely stupid. Yet they backed him all the way through and didn't provide that support. And you just think, guys, you know, this is a management thing. You've not made sure everything's in a row. If you're going to back him, make sure he stands a chance of winning, or don't back him. So they did. They managed to do the worst of both things there. And somewhere along the line, the bike didn't really make the difference. I do worry whether Aprilia will be here in a few years' time. I really do. Because it's costing them money. And I'm not at all convinced the boss of Aprilia is sufficiently a fan of MotoGP to want to spend the money for the hell of it. You know, for Ducati, it's like Ferrari. It's part of their DNA now. If they want to sell sports bikes, they need to go racing. But for Aprilia, you know, they sell more scooters than anybody else in Europe and India.
Yeah, Piaggio.
They're not an insignificant player, but they don't need to be winning MotoGP to do it. I mean, arguably, what they need to be doing is just developing a nice low emission two stroke. You know, they've been there before; they can do it again, or an electric one. But yes. So I'm not only disappointed, but quite concerned for the future for them, to be honest.
Interesting to listen to you, Neil. It's always a pleasure to spend some time together.
Okay, sorry. There's one more thing.
Yeah.
Michelin brought that new rear tire. It was supposed to be followed this year with a new front tire. Because there was not enough testing, it's not coming. That new front tire could have solved a lot of the problems. But now the factories have got to work with the back tire from one generation and the front tire from the old generation for one more year.
So it's not really balanced, the performance of the tires. No.
No.
Thanks a lot, Neil, for your time.
Cheers, chaps. Enjoy. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Mycket intressant att lyssna på Neil Spaulding och ha möjlighet att ställa frågor. Eller vad säger du, Andreas?
Ja, det är alltid roligt att prata med han, för han har ögon för det, just det tekniska.
Ja, men det känns så. Det är både med egen erfarenhet från sadeln, han har kört själv också, och dessutom de många år i MotoGP-depån. Jag gillar analyserna och funderingarna som han har.
Verkligen. Och vi kan ju varmt rekommendera hans bok också, MotoGP Technology. Och jag tror faktiskt att den är slutsåld och kommer inte säljas mer. Av en händelse så har jag ju kommit över ett litet parti som vi får se vad vi ska göra av dem framöver.
Ja, håll utkik alltså i nästkommande eller framtida poddar inför möjligheten att kanske förvärva en sån här bok då. Som sagt, var väldigt matnyttig. Och sen också tycker jag är intressant att höra det här med hans kopplingar, Sigma Performance Clutches, som finns till allehanda sportmodeller på motorcyklar som kan hjälpa upp till exempel sådana här track days, åkning och annat. Men Med det så kan vi nästan börja avrunda den här podden tycker jag, och också se fram emot nästa vecka. Det kommer bli ännu mer matnyttigt och fullmatad timme och ta in. Johan Stigefelt kommer vara med i den kommande podden.
Ja, den får ni absolut inte missa. För där kommer lite bakgrundsinformation och lite inside information hur till exempel Quartararo blev värvad till Petronas-teamet.
Mm. Intressant lyssning alltså att se fram emot. Med detta så tackar vi för denna vecka.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.